Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries. This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 35. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. How is ritual important to the safe and proper use of entheogens? How does ritual help facilitate a deeper entheogenic experience? What is 5-MeO-DMT, and why is it so seldom discussed in entheogenic studies? And what is TOAD? Today I interview Hal Lucius Nation, the Grand Archbishop of the Temple of Awakening Divinity, or TOAD. 5-MeO-DMT, or 5-methoxy-N,N-dimethyltryptamine, is probably the most powerful of all entheogens and is not a Schedule I narcotic. Simultaneously, it is one of the least studied and discussed of all entheogens today. Like its cousin, N,N-DMT, 5-MeO-DMT is a natural neurotransmitter found in all mammalian brains. In this interview, I'll be looking into the use of ritual, as well as the ritualistic use of 5-MeO-DMT, and discussing some of the practices of the Temple of Awakening Divinity. Upcoming shows, hopefully next week I'll have on Eddie Lepp, one of California's largest medical marijuana growers, whose farm was raided in 2004 by federal agents. Just a heads up, as I mentioned last week, I'll be traveling out of the country for a bit, so there may or may not be a show next week, depending on timing, but if I do put the show out, it will likely go out on Sunday morning or Saturday evening. Eddie recently received a 10-year sentence, and he's supposed to report on July 6th for prison should his appeal fail, and so I'd like to get him on the show to discuss the medical marijuana movement and, you know, the violation of states' rights, states' constitutional rights as designated by the Constitution. Whatever's not designated in the Constitution itself is left to the states to decide. And California has legalized medical marijuana, and the federal government is not recognizing the Constitution. As well as I hope to discuss with him the continual prosecution of medical marijuana growers and club owners for supplying medical marijuana when there is no other method to get it to the people except on the black market, which is also illegal. So they're not allowing patients any legal means to acquire medication. And so... hopefully that will be a good interview and get that on next week. On my return, I have several other interviews in the works, so we'll see how things go, but I can't make any promises on the next release date, but it'll probably be sometime in mid-July for the next show, which from there I should be able to get on. We have Acharya S. lined up again, Steve Hagar from High Times Magazine, and Steven Zerlinga on U.S. economy, as well as possibly having Michael Sarian on. So that should be an interesting show. And also thanks to Russell, Max, Kent, and Jillian for coming through with donations in the last week. Thanks, guys. And you have no idea how much I appreciate your help And we haven't had much in the way of donations lately, and I know times are slow and things are tough, so thanks again, guys. And I ask anyone else out there, if you can please support the show, please do. Please don't wait for someone else to donate. It's your support we need. And for about every 12,000 listeners to this show, only one or two of you donates. And several of those people who donate are regular donators, so the number of new supporters to the show is low. So please, whether you can afford to donate $2 or $50 or whatever in between, please don't hesitate to go to GnosticMedia.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. And I had two more people respond this week, but we still need more help with the transcriptions of these interviews. If you can help out with the shows, there's a lot of stuff here we could use help on, so maybe you're interested in helping. So again, it's a fantastic way to help if you can't afford to donate, and please contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And you can also support this show by ordering a copy of the DVD or one of the books at the website gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. And you can get Astrotheology and Shamanism. I have about 42 copies left of the color, numbered, and signed edition, which comes with a free Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD. And I do still have copies of The Holy Mushroom available, which is my latest book. Those go out autographed as well, but not numbered. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. And if you'd like to contact me directly, please contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And here is my interview with Halucius Nation. Enjoy. All right, Halucius Nation, welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast 35.
Thanks very much, Jan. It's a pleasure to be here and really privileged to be on your show.
Well, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. And I figured, you know, with Burning Man coming up and my interactions with you over the last 6 months, I figured it'd be an interesting and quite different show. I'll admit right up front, probably not the usual heavily academic show that I do, but at the same time, nonetheless important. And I certainly feel that you do significant work in a specific area, which we'll talk about more in the interview, but that is actually starting to gain more recognition and of importance by many of the academics out there. So, you know, I wanted to have you on and wanted to talk about what you've got going on there. So anyway, welcome.
Thanks very much, and again, really appreciate being here, and I hope I can deliver to your audience something that they'll enjoy, and it'll help me at least in getting you to stop begging me. So,
okay, and well, let's start off by telling me a little bit about yourself. Who is Halucius Nation?
Well, Halucius Nation is a pseudonym, obviously, for myself. I am the founder and chief officiant of the Temple of Awakening Divinity. I've been a student and teacher and practitioner of the Western Mystery School tradition for nearly 20 years. And I've done a lot of work in ceremonial magic, Raja Yoga, Hermetic Kabbalah, transpersonal alchemy, comparative religious studies, ontology. And all of this work has gone to prepare me for what I feel was my personal entheogenic gnosis, which I received back in 2005, being exposed to the Eucharist that we utilize, which we affectionately refer to as Samadhi, and is known chemically as 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine. Took me about a year to really integrate my initial reception of that sacrament. And upon receiving the sacrament a second time in 2007, I really felt called by Source to bring this revelation of this great mystery to others. And in doing so, I established the Temple of Awakening Divinity to bring entheogenic spirituality to those who are drawn to having a deeper, direct experience of the divine. And I've been doing that now. We first started doing circles at the Temple of Waking Divinity in late 2007, and I've been conducting regular circles several a month ever since then, all over the West Coast.
So, what is your background as a person? Who is the you behind Halucious Nation? What do you do? What do you like to do?
Spirituality and work with entheogenic medicines and sacred sexuality happens to be my area of focus. I have worked as a thelemic ceremonial magician for a long time. Work with thelemic Gnosticism. In my real world guise, I work in the media industry, and I've been doing that for a long time, but I'd rather keep the focus of our conversation on my entheogenic work.
Well, let's talk about your background in ceremonial magic. What can you say about that?
Sure. Like I said, I've been practicing studying and teaching ceremonial magic for almost 20 years. I am a member of several ceremonial magical orders. I said specifically thelemic ceremonial magic. Thelema is a spiritual philosophy that derives from many sources, including St. Augustine and Rabelais, and was primarily put forward by Aleister Crowley, who was a poet and magician and mountaineer and explorer of spirituality at the earlier part of the 20th century. And so I work with a lot of traditions. The Temple of Awakening Divinity, while its primary tenets are based on thelemic Gnosticism, is really much more of a syncretic organization. It's really not associated with any other organizations, although it has elements of thelemic Gnosticism put forward within the context of the work. But when I say it's syncretic, is that we don't ask people who come to the Temple of Awakening Divinity to believe anything. In fact, we really discourage dogmatic constructs in their entirety, because we really feel that they tend to distance and separate people from experiencing Source directly. And that's what the Temple of Awakening Divinity is really about. It's about utilizing an entheogenic sacrament or Eucharist in a ceremonial setting to allow individuals to have a direct experience of Source. And that's really what it's all about. And so when people come to the Temple of Awakening Divinity, there is a screening process that they go through. But we really work from a sense that, from an idea that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Or in other words, that if they find out about the Temple of Awakening Divinity and they're able to make contact with the Temple of Awakening Divinity, they go through the screening process, they end up in the temple, they're likely in the right place. And so far, that's worked out quite well.
Talk about the Temple of Awakening Divinity that you mentioned a minute ago, and what is this acronym TOAD?
Well, TOAD, of course, stands for the Temple of Awakening Divinity, and It's a little tongue-in-cheek and refers to the idea of the Bufo alvarius toad, also known as the Sonoran desert toad, whose venom contains 5-MeO-DMT. Although the Eucharist that we generally use at the Temple of Awakening Divinity, again, what we refer to as Samadhi, which is a Hindu term, which means union with God or union with the divine, not only exists in the Bufo alvarius toad, it exists in the brains of all mammals, and it also exists in many plants. And the Samadhi we actually utilize at the Temple of Awakening Divinity currently is an extract from a plant known as Varola Theodora. And it's quite effective, quite powerful entheogen, and that's kind of the basis of the origin of the acronym TOAD.
Talk about Liber Alvelegus, or the Book of the Law. How is that important to your work?
Yes, Liber Alvelegus, the Book of the Law, which is the primary holy book within the context of the Thelemic spirituality or the Thelemic religion. It was received in 1904 by Aleister Crowley in Cairo. I say it was received because it was effectively a transmitted work that he wrote over the course of 3 days. It's a book in three chapters. Primarily focuses on the three primary deities within the Thelemic tradition. I'm not going to go into the technical aspects of that, but within the context of the Book of the Law, it's a very beautiful sacred text. There's one particular chapter and verse that inspired me really to create the Temple of Awakening Divinity. And that would be chapter 2, verse 22. And while I don't want to quote chapter and verse, and so I won't, that was what gave me the impetus to really kind of found the Temple of Awakening Divinity based on this idea of Thelemic Gnosticism and about really having direct experience of the divine. I mean, in my practice, for nearly 20 years, which is primarily based on three principles, ceremonial magic, Raja Yoga, and Hermetic Kabbalah. I've been a practitioner of Raja Yoga for a long time, you know, based on the works of Patanjali that have moved forward in time. I study the works of Swami Vivekananda quite a bit and have had a regular Raja Yoga practice for quite some time. In yoga, the highest states of attainment is known as samadhi. Technically, it's actually samayama, which is samadhi with control. But this idea of samadhi, or direct union with God, is something I've been working on for quite some time. And I've achieved really exalted states utilizing techniques of ceremonial magic, Raja Yoga. But it wasn't until I had the opportunity to experience 5-MeO-DMT that I really experienced samadhi in a way that was so far beyond anything I had ever imagined that really, really got my attention and really stirred me and moved me incredibly deeply. And in fact, during my first experience with 5-MeO-DMT, the only thing I could say and kept saying was, I knew it was real. 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 Meaning that I knew that this state of intimate connection with the divine was possible. I had been in some really exalted states, yet I have never experienced anything as absolutely transcendent, as absolutely connected to source in its truest possible way than with this particular visionary plant medicine. And so once I had discovered that, you know, I mentioned it took me about a year to really process that. And I went through a long period of time where I just started reading everything I could get my hands on from Terence McKenna and Jeremy Narby and just countless authors, the Center for Spiritual Practice, you know, I just read everything I could get my hands on in terms of entheogenic spirituality. Rick Strassman's book, of course, DMT, the Spirit Molecule, and you know, countless others. To really get a grasp, I also want to mention a really important work is Orok's book, Tryptamine Palace. The new version of that's coming out this month in June. And so I got turned on to these works, and I said, wow, you know, this is something that that others know about. And it then when I experienced the medicine for a second time in 2007, it was really, really clear that that Source wanted me to carry this medicine forward. And I'd never done anything like that before and was really surprised, you know, essentially took an oath to myself and the universe to do this. And I don't take these things very lightly. And I had no idea how I was going to do that. And and really, it came about very organically. I mean, I took some steps. I actually obtained some Bufo alvarius toads and came into relationship with them and worked with them quite a bit, and then was able to secure this plant-based medicine, and have been working with that ever since. And for those who are really interested in finding out a lot more about the Temple of Awakening Divinity, Martin Ball's book, The Entheogenic Evolution, is an outstanding piece of work in terms of really laying out what we do at the temple and how it works. I mean, Martin, who's my dearest friend, just did an outstanding job in really conveying the work that we do at the temple. And I'm very grateful.
Well, you're kind of skipping ahead there a little bit, so I did want to come back to that later. But
sure.
Well, you know, I've got to admit, you know, a lot of people that are listening to this show are first going to think, you know, what the heck is Jan doing? This is a really weird interview compared to what I usually have on, number one. And number two, I know there are going to be people out in the audience who are automatically going to say, you know, Aleister Crowley, wasn't he a devil worshiper? You know, and I want to ask you from there, was he a devil worshiper or was his work misunderstood? Let me add to that, that a lot of people are going to say that since your work incorporates Aleister Crowley's work in some way or Thelema, whatever, however you want to incorporate it, that you must be a part of some satanic cult or you're a heretic or something to that effect. So what do you have to say to those points?
Well, there's a number of questions there. The first thing I would say is that Aleister Crowley was definitely misunderstood and continues to be misunderstood. Some of that is based on his own intentional misperceptions that he liked to throw out about himself. Secondarily, I would say that Aleister Crowley was a researcher into various forms of religious and ontological practice and ritual forms. So at one time or another, Crowley was a Christian, was raised as a devout Christian, a member of the Plymouth Brethren. At another point in his life, he firmly rejected Christianity. I don't think he ever rejected the inner teachings of Christianity. And
the esoteric teachings.
I would definitely have to say that that would be accurate. I think what he rejected were the exoteric and rather hypocritical aspects of fundamentalist forms of Christianity.
I would have to agree with that myself, I think.
But at one time or another, he, you know, was a spiritual practitioner of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hermeticism. He has a couple of rituals that utilize forms that include archetypes that could be considered satanic, whatever that might mean. So the idea here is that, yes, his work is greatly misunderstood, but he was probably one of the most experienced researchers into the spiritual phenomenon within the context of the 20th century. So for people who might think that what I am doing is satanic in any way, I would really invite them to come and sit in my circle and see what it is that I do, and then see if they still have that feeling. One thing that I would say, the work that I'm doing is quite heretical in that I believe and feel strongly that people can have a direct experience of the divine and don't need any kind of religious, formalized religious structure to get there, that they can just have it.
So what you're saying is that basically, even though you've studied all of this stuff, as did Crowley and everything, basically what you're doing is throwing all of that out and showing people how they can have their own direct experience without any form of dogma.
Yes and no. The fundamental idea of religion is based on the Latin religere, right? Ligature, to reconnect. So that posits a presupposition that we are somehow disconnected from the divine or source, and then need these specific forms that have been created in order to reconnect. I believe that that's a fundamental misconception. I believe that we are all intimately connected with the divine all the time. And the only thing that keeps us from realizing that is our own limited perspective, meaning that our egoic consciousness, which we exist in our normal states as humans, veils, and it's a very, very thin veil, what lies beneath that. And that is our absolute intimate connection with the divine. So does that mean we need to throw out all of these dogmatic constructs? Yes, if they keep us from that realization. Now, I want to take that back because there's some caveats. The caveats are these structured forms that we call, you know, our various exoteric religions, they all have a basis in this direct spiritual experience. In fact, I will actually hold that any mystical experience, and this is pretty bold, bold theory, any spiritual experience that anyone has ever had throughout time, including all of the great sages and teachers and sadhus and avatars and godmen, whatever we'd like to call them, had that experience because of a chemical reaction in their brains that opened them up to the divine. Now, that could have happened either exogenously, meaning they took it in from some outside source, or it happened endogenously, meaning that they participated in some form of practice that opened up and allowed their pineal to release this particular molecule into their brains that allowed them to have this experience. So that's a pretty bold stance that I'm taking on that. And I will, you know, I invite anybody to bring any kind of refutation of that forward. Now, then people will say, well, that's kind of reductionist. You're reducing all spiritual experience to this, you know, you're saying this chemical is the spiritual experience. I'm not, because the chemical is merely a key. And what the spiritual experience is, which is a subjective experience, involves the interrelation between our personal consciousness, which then the molecule provides a key into our particular receptor site, which is designed to receive that molecule, that then opens up this doorway into direct communion with the divine, which is in us anyways. So what I'm saying is, and what could be considered very heretical, is that we do not of necessity need these religious forms and frameworks that presently exist. However, many of them are so beautiful and such expressions of beauty and love in a particular cultural context, that to not utilize them, to not use the traditions of the ancient Greeks or the traditions of the Sufis or the traditions of the Kabbalists would be a massive waste. And these traditions help us inform our global context for our connection with source throughout a vast history. So they're all incredibly beautiful, but when they're utilized to create separation and to create the wars that we see raging across our planet, they are not useful to us. And so they would need to be abandoned if they indeed create separation. Boy, and I really went on that.
Yeah, well, that was, I thought that was well said, actually. And, Professor Michael Winkelman on recently, who his most recent book is Supernatural is Natural, A Biocultural Approach to Religion. And he gets into a lot of discussion on ritual and on the origins of ritual and, how basically ritual and then, many animals have rituals that they perform. Certain fish do mating rituals, apes, sure. all sorts of animals do many types of rituals. You know, dogs will chase their tail before they sit down to poo in the yard or something like that, you know?
Well, let's get clear and kind of define what ritual is.
Well, hold on a second. But, ritual, and there are many different levels to ritual, and but ritual is like, let's say a lizard climbs out of his hole every morning and decides to take a specific path to the water hole. Or there are groups of chimpanzees who during a thunderstorm will climb on top of a hill with branches and shriek at the sky and then go back and do their thing. And that's been reported as well. But interestingly, what Winkelman points out is that religion and ritual are essential to human evolution, and that or evolution in general, because almost every animal and every species uses ritual to some method or another. And basically, when ritual becomes religion, it also becomes in group law, the group or tribal law. And then those tribal laws become things like the Talmud or Deuteronomy, the Book of Law and stuff like that. And these were the laws of the tribe to help adhere them together so that they could survive as a group and how to deal with outside foes and things like that. Sure. But eventually, we come to a point where we're in a global society, and suddenly we have these different religions instead of working as a whole and working together to keep us together and working on the ultimate goal of the planet and humanity. What they're doing is dividing us between Gentiles or Goyim and Jews or shamans or, this group and that group, this minority and that minority, and they're separating us, the Muslims. And the Muslims are often a target of this or that viciousness. But when we get into a lot of these ancient texts, the Bible comes to mind, so many just blatantly racist persecutions of different groups of people. And you have certainly the Talmud has many of the same types of concepts in there. And so these things drive to separate us and drive us apart instead of bringing us closer to that core. So that was kind of where I wanted to go with that. And Winkelman's book really shows how we're really at a point where we've outgrown religion, and we either need to evolve religion, or we need to dispose of it before ourselves get disposed of. And, who knows which is going to happen first. We may end up running ourselves like lemmings off the cliff.
Yeah. And that's why, the Temple of Awakening Divinity exists as a syncretic spiritual organization, meaning that we don't create those kinds of divisions. We invite all to participate and all to attend, because source is just source. And, You know, and really the Temple of Awakening Divinity exists simply to provide a safe and practical context for the direct spiritual experience of the divine for its participants through a ceremonial rite of entheogenic Eucharistic communion. That's it. That's it. It doesn't need any more. It doesn't need to have dogmatic structures. In fact, we specifically eschew dogmatic structures as they tend to create division and generally serve to distance individuals from the direct spiritual experience of the divine that we seek to foster and provide to people. So we have no formal requirements of specific religious or spiritual belief or practices for anyone wishing to attend the gatherings of the Toad. And each individual that seeks participation in our activities is really left to their own to develop their own unique understanding of their particular spiritual nature and their particular relationship with the divine. And we encourage people to develop their own spiritual praxis that suits their particular needs as they deem fit. Now, we offer some integrative practices, we offer some suggestive practices, and those I'm just beginning to develop now, but you know, it's really important that people get that it's about their personal relationship with the divine. Now, there are wonderful practices within a lot of spiritual traditions, the yogin practices within Hinduism, the meditative practices of Dzogchen and different forms of Buddhism. I'm a practicing Hermetic Kabbalist, so I use the Kabbalah, which is kind of the language of the occult, the language of the hidden, to be able to identify, you know, particular states. So these are very useful aspects, but they are not absolutely necessary for this experience to occur. I was listening to your interview with Benny Shannon the other day, and he was speaking to this idea that, you know, in talking about ayahuasca, that it may not necessarily have to be that we intake an entheogen to have this experience. In the future, we may figure out another way to have this experience. And those are all vital. I always say it's not about how you get there. It's about getting there. Because everybody needs to know this. The thing is that for millennia, religions have been used to control and dominate people. And that's wrong. But, you know, God exists. God is a real deal. And it's everything. And it's you. And it's me. And it's expressing itself into material reality through us. And we're either conscious of it or we're not conscious of it. We either have an intellectual understanding of it or an intellectual belief in what it might be, or we have a noetic understanding of what it is because we've been there, really been there. And there's no mistaking it when you're there. And I know you know what I'm talking about. And, you know, so, you know, we generally like when people come to the Temple of Awakening Divinity that they have some level of practical spiritual work and understanding to give them a context for participation in the work of the temple. But as far as readiness is concerned, it's generally left up to the individual themselves, as well as the judgment of a temple officiant who puts these people through a fairly detailed interview and intake to see if they're feeling like this is something that they're being called to and that they're ready for. And generally that works pretty good for us.
Well, let's get into ritual. You know, and I think this is something that is really important. And I interviewed Marlene DeRios recently, and she talked about how ritual is really the most important aspect of doing these substances in a safe set and setting. And in fact, that's probably the one of the biggest problems with our own culture in using these things, is that we've lost our own rituals and things that, you know, our own tribes used to use way back wherever your or my families may have come from. And, you know, so in Western society, we really don't have these rituals anymore. So we have to create them. And you know, what's interesting is people that get into using ayahuasca, I find, and, you know, a number of the studies point this out as well, is that they start to sort of naturally create these rituals around the use of the ayahuasca, or the ayahuasca helps facilitate the creation of the ritual. Mm-hmm. It's sort of in and of itself, you know, it's sort of, you know, one perpetuates the other at the same time. And, but what it seems is that, in our society, since we don't have this, and what should also be said is that in the shamanic societies, the traditional indigenous cultures who do use these rituals, that really seems to be the key element in guiding the person through the entheogenic experience. And so that's probably, in my opinion, other than your work on 5-MeO-DMT, the most important thing, you know, because nobody really out there talks about 5-MeO-DMT. I know very few people other than myself who have tried it. And, you know, so, you know, let's get in and talk about ritual. You know, talk about if you were going to, you know, and I know that Martin Ball's book goes into this a little bit, but if you were to describe the rituals that you do and the things that you perform in the temple and things like that, would you mind discussing that so that people can kind of get a grasp on the importance of this? And let me add that, you know, I tried 5-MeO-DMT several times over the years before I did it under the ritual setting with the Temple of Awakening Divinity up there in January with you and Martin. And, you know, I've got to say that the way, you know, it was one of my most profound experiences. I wouldn't say that it was the most, but it was certainly up there as one of the top 3, 4, 5 most profound, I would say, of my life. And you guys were, especially you, were performing in a lot of different rituals and things there that, you know, before, when I was going into it, I have to admit that having done entheogens for years myself, I didn't really think that a lot of what you were doing was that important. In fact, I thought a lot of it was silly or just show. And then by the end of the ceremony and after going through it all, I was dumbfounded and I went, oh, you know, this ritual aspect is really far more important than I and many people have given it consideration. And so I'll leave it at that and let you go from there.
Thanks. I appreciate it, Jan. And it was really a pleasure having you at the temple. I've been a ritual ceremonial magician for a long time. So that requires some definitions. And it really, I want to give you a little background in terms of my story around this too, is that I started out really profoundly believing in my life that I was destined for the stage, that I was destined to be an actor. In fact, I studied acting in college and did a bit of acting throughout the years. And, you know, I was always very drawn to it. And yet there was a piece of it that I always felt like I was kind of prostituting myself. I loved doing theater. I would do film, which I also love. I've been in media for years, but I always felt that somehow I was like debasing my gift. And then as I got into studying ceremonial magic and then practicing ceremonial magic and doing rituals of ceremonial magic, one night I found myself out in the woods of the Angeles Crest with a group of magicians doing some ecstatic work where I was invoking Dionysus through song and dance and drumming, and was really exalting my consciousness in a big way. And suddenly Dionysus showed up. And what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean by that is that an energetic force came into me and completely surrounded the group that was absolutely palpable and undeniable. And it had this force or energetic of Dionysian ecstasy. And in that moment, I realized that my entire life up to that point in my acting had been to get me to this moment, to have this realization that what I really was passionate about was calling in spirit and calling in the divine and calling in source and connecting with it.
And also, it also sounds like there's an underlying theme of being in the here and now in that as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You become completely present. And so so that's really got me going, okay, this ceremonial magic thing, this is good. I like this. So I continued to do it. I worked with a lot of really amazing people who were involved in this. And I mean, these are professional people. These are psychologists and psychotherapists and working professionals. And I mean, these are and academics that do this work. I've worked in Neo-Eleusinian traditions. I've worked in Golden Dawn-based traditions. I've worked with other Thelemic ceremonial magical groups. And these are pretty amazing people. And so at any rate, doing my ceremonial work was very interesting in that finally when this revelation came to me that I was going to bring this entheogenic spiritual work forward, I realized that everything I had done up until this point in terms of my study and work in this Western Mystery School tradition was all bringing me to this point of being able to create this ritual context for receiving the entheogenic Eucharist. So it was just really funny in that way. So that's the backstory. So then to get with, you know, how we utilize that at the Temple of Awakening Divinity, I think it's important that we look at the idea of, you know, what is ritual? What is ceremony? You talked about that briefly. You know, ritual is really any intentional, repeated action. And sometimes it's not intentional. Our habits, to a particular degree, are unconscious rituals. Smoking, for an example, is, you know, picking up that cigarette and lighting it up and inhaling in a particular way. That's a ritual in and of itself, even though it may be being done on an unconscious level. So that's ritual, this idea of repeated action. Then you have ceremony. So ceremony is this intentional construct for creating what I like to refer to as a magical context. Now that makes me talk about magic. Crowley's definition of magic, which I really like, is the art and science of causing change or transformation, is the word I like better, transformation to occur in conformity with will. So technically, any willed intentional act, by definition, is a magical act. So what I do at the Temple of Awakening Divinity is I use very specific ceremonial magical ritual form to simply create a context or a container for people to safely utilize this very, very powerful entheogenic Eucharist and to make them comfortable enough to be able to release entirely into the experience. So that's very, very different from, you know, taking psilocybin mushrooms at a festival event, you know? So what I'm really doing is I am controlling both the set as much as I can, because controlling people's mindset is always the variable, but I am controlling setting down to an almost scientific condition. I was listening to Roland Griffiths talk about the psilocybin study at Johns Hopkins, and they, you know, they were doing a lot to control that setting. And Martin Ball and I were talking about the fact that I have such a rigorously controlled setting that that's about as scientific as you can get. The Eucharist is always the same. The setting, the ritual form of the setting is always the same. The only thing that's different is the set, is what each individual brings into this container of safety that I'm creating. And I've been very, very effective in doing that. And thank you for your candor, too, in expressing your feelings that you thought that some of it was silly. you know, because it's important for your audience to get this. And this is across the spectrum of all religious ceremony. We perform ritual and ceremonies to commemorate and generally celebrate particular things. Baptism in terms of birth, confirmation in terms of coming from age, the bris or circumcision at birth, which is a scary concept. you know, and in more culturally, we're starting to begin, you know, in our cultural, in our culture here in the West, we really have a lack of ritual. And so ritual comes out in kind of sociopathic ways. I mean, ritual in the United States, the biggest ritual we have in the United States is football. Because football is this ritual that men usually get together and like watch like weekly and very rigorously, and they know all of the detail. And the thing that's beautiful about it is that you don't know what's going to happen with the outcome. And so that brings this component into play. But it also expresses itself in gangs, because we have no initiatic context within our culture. Our youth have to put themselves through rites of passage, and usually, you know, that's either being introduced to sexuality or drugs in some way, in a way that is not really all that healthy. So in ancient cultures, we used to ritualize these initiatic states and honor them and celebrate them. So at the Temple of Awakening Divinity, that's what we're really doing. And the context that I'm using, the construct, isn't what's important. Like, exactly what I'm doing isn't really important. I could create, for example, a ceremonial context for the Temple of Awakening Divinity that was all in utilizing the ancient Greek forms or the ancient Hebraic forms or the, you know, or Hindu forms. That's the beauty about ceremonial magic, is that when you kind of can step back for a moment and take in the full spectrum of religious egregores that exist throughout the world, then we recognize we can pick and choose any one of them, because source is one and unified. And all of these paths are just merely different paths to that one source. That creates them as elegant, artistic forms that have rich cultural egregores or channels of energy behind them, group minds behind them. And then we can begin to recognize how they are all intimately woven together, and each contains its own beautiful thread in the tapestry that is the spiritual unfoldment of Gaia, that's the spiritual unfoldment of everybody on the planet. Instead of dividing it, then it weaves it all together in this beautiful textured tapestry that is just gorgeous and full. And then, you know, we can recognize that they all have wonderful things that we can take and utilize in our lives and in our own spirituality. And they all have things that maybe aren't so useful to us, at least in how they're being interpreted. So ultimately, within the Temple of Awakening Divinity, I'm using some specific ritual tech to create this context, what I refer to as a sacred vessel, within which each person coming to the temple can then kind of coalesce their own particular unique expression of spirit within, and then have that that profound collective experience in their own way, in their own personal way, of experiencing the divine. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it did.
You know, so the one thing I want to say that's important is, again, for example, I do something that's called a banishing, which actually creates what I feel is a zero point field within the physical nexus of the room, but also within the consciousness of each person there. And it involves speaking some Hebrew God names and speaking some Hebrew archangelic names. You know, my sense is that that it doesn't really matter if the person there understands what I'm saying, if they believe in these God names, if they believe in these archangelic forms. I don't even know, frankly, if it matters that I believe in them.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm saying? Martin and I have this conversation quite a bit.
Oh, right, right.
It's that I'm using this form to assist me in creating this context.
Well, and that's kind of what I'm trying to get at in this show. It's that it's the creation and the act of the ritual itself, no matter how absurd it is, or if you just made it up this morning and didn't even pull it out of ancient Hebraic or Hindi or some ancient text or whatever. I mean, if you made it all up this morning and decided just to act it out, it seems that becomes the most important aspect. And then, you know, in that kicking off or starting point itself, it seems that the ritualistic aspects will sort of want to create themselves. Now, let me caveat myself there with that and you know, admit that, you know, many times over the years, you know, and there were a few occasions when I started to do this or that ritual and I just didn't let myself go and become the actor in it, which so many of these teachings seem to make people good at is that role playing and that acting. And you know, I did some of it for a while, and I also practiced breaking rituals. In other words, getting up in the morning and making sure to drive a different direction to work each day, or always start off by combing my hair differently from a different point on my head, or putting my shoes on differently or something like that, and just being aware of, or trying to become aware of the ritualistic behavior that we do. It sort of made me aware of those things. But at the same time, for many years, I guess I got to a point where I didn't think that it was important. And now I find myself coming back to it years later and seeing how the importance is. It's really a key significant piece of the structured set and setting of the psychedelic or, you know, spontaneous even religious experience, however you want to label that. So hopefully that wasn't too out there and roundabout and back again, but
no, although there is an aspect of it where I'll disagree with you. I mentioned this word egregores, which not a lot of people know the definition of, and I kind of threw it out there, and I think it's worthy of going back. An egregore is the idea of a group mind, and how it relates to religious structures is important, and this is the example I like to give. So you have this very fertile ground of spirituality that's like an untilled field, and if I take my finger, and let's say my finger is a particular spiritual practice or tradition, and I dig it into that soil of spirituality, I create this little rut. And then if force or source energy, you know, in a particular form of that rut begins to flow through it, through regular practice, that rut will begin to widen out and will turn into a channel. And if more spiritual force, belief, energy is put into that, it'll widen out until it becomes a stream, until it becomes a creek, until it becomes a river, and then flows into the ocean of pure source. So our different religious forms are like that. So that the more that gets invested into them, the deeper those channels become in the collective unconscious of the species. So if there is particular forms that have been worked over and over and over and over again for a long time, if I step into that practice and I can really connect with it, then I can gain all of that energy that's already flowing through it. Does that make sense? As opposed to if I just make it up on the spot. Well, however, spontaneous ritual is some of the most profound ritual that can be done. It just needs to be grounded in a context. And like any kind of practice, if one wishes to become a virtuoso violin player, they're going to play and play and play and play and practice their scales until they're there. The same thing holds with creating ritual. And, in ceremony, I've done ceremony over the years and ritual practice over the years so much that I can now just bring those aspects into play in what I'm doing in the context of the temple. But again, the main thing is, why am I creating the ritual? The ritual, creating any ritual is all about intent. What is my intent? Why am I creating this ritual? What is it supposed to do? The intent of the ritual around the Temple of Awakening Divinity exists for one thing and one thing only. And that's to create a solid vessel or container for people to fully experience direct connection to Source. And that's it. So it's important, because what ends up happening is that we end up getting caught up in things like the kosher laws and or these different practices that people do, and they don't even know why they do them anymore. And it's just because some guy did them way back when, but it doesn't really serve us in our purpose. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh,
in fact, a lot of people really like coming to the Temple of Awakening Divinity as opposed to doing ayahuasca work or work with mescaline, because those are kind of hard roads. And the Temple of Awakening Divinity, even though the 5-MeO-DMT experience is probably the most profound entheogenic experience you can have and is really big and can be scary for some people.
Including
is
myself
also,
at times.
Yes, but I create a very gentle container for people to come in and not only have this deep experience of Source and Spirit, but also to have a really moving experience with other people in the room and a really deep physical experience as well, and to really experience love and connectivity. And that's one thing that really gets created at the Temple of Awakening Divinity that I've never seen or rarely seen in other places. I mean, I bring people together who don't even know each other, from totally different spectrums in life. I assemble them into a small group, and by the time we're done, they are the closest friends you can imagine, because they've had this deeply intimate, shared spiritual experience that, in many cases, is the most profound experience of their lives. So, and that's beautiful, that kind of connection, because that's really what we're looking for. That's what religion is about. It's about reconnecting. So I believe we can get rid of the re entirely and just have religion. Just have connection. Because once you've had that experience, I mean, you might be able to forget it, maybe, but I don't see how. I mean, your ego will reassert itself. You will go through your egoic crap. But once you've had that experience, I mean, I know on a noetic level that God exists, that I am intimately connected with God, and that God is the fullest expression of love that manifests itself out from pure deific consciousness into physical form, and that we are direct extensions of that living into the world, co-creating with the divine, because we are that.
So would you say, is that your description of the 5-MeO-DMT experience?
I would say that there is no possible way to describe the 5-MeO-DMT experience. Is there any kind of languaging, any type of intellectualizing at all about it, just will not do it justice, because it is not a rational experience. It does not exist in rational consciousness. It is a trans-rational phenomena,
transrational. That sounds like something that, to a lot of people, you'd want to be careful with saying that word.
it's beyond rational. It transcends rational. So let me give you, here's a great example of how you can use a religious construct or religious idea to kind of explain this, because the ancient Kabbalists postulate, you know, in their theories of emanationism around the Kabbalistic tree of life, which is, you know, essentially, and I will, I also have some ideas about this, because I believe that this is not just a Hebraic idea. I'm a Hermetic, I believe Hermetic Kabbalah, which is that I believe that all traditions can actually map onto this tree quite well. But the idea is the Kabbalists, the ancient Kabbalists postulated existence existing in what they called the four worlds. The first world they called Atzaluth, which is a Hebrew word. It basically can be defined as pure God consciousness, nothing but God consciousness. Then there was a world that they kind of postulated below that, if you will, hierarchically, that they called Bria, which is called the creative, which is the archetypal world. So it exists beyond form and ideas, but it's where form comes from. It's kind of what Plato related to as the forms. It's the architecture that our ideas clothe. And that world, the world of thoughts and ideas and symbol, they called Yetzirah, which is the world of formation. So this is the world of thoughts and ideas that begin to move down through this continuum of consciousness. And then we finally ground that in what they called the world of Asiyah, which is the world of material existence. So this is, these four worlds are not kind of discrete. They are this continuum that exists between pure God consciousness and physical consciousness. So when I say transrational, I'm saying that I'm moving beyond this world of thoughts, forms, ideas, and concepts into a world that is beyond that. Now, I believe when you take dimethyltryptamine, if you smoke straight NMDMT, that that takes you into the world just above this rational world that I'm talking about, and it moves you into this creative world that I would say the Kabbalists called Bria, which is this archetypal world, and that the hallucinations, the visual hallucinations you actually see are these archetypes. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Are these, I just heard a weird sound. Are these archetypal constructs impressing themselves into the rational, into the reasoning, formative aspects of our minds? And that what we're, and that's what we see when we take ayahuasca, is that it is these archetypal, that's why there's such kind of a ubiquitous, you know, people have this same experience of jaguars and snakes and plant life and the lady of the forest, that these exist as archetypal forms. Now, whether they're discrete and, you know, objective realities, I'm not even going to go there, but that doesn't really matter that much, because the fact of the matter is that there are archetypal aspects impressing themselves into our conscious mind, and that's our interface, right? Then when you do 5-MeO-DMT, you blow right past that creative archetypal realm, and you go directly into God consciousness. Do not pass go, do not collect $200, is that you go directly into source. And then when you're coming back from that experience, you know, I always say, people ask me, well, how long is this experience? I say it's 20 minutes up to down with another 10 to 20 minutes for your ego to actually reintegrate back into consciousness. And that process of egoic reintegration is really pretty unique. I know the first time that I had this experience, I actually could sense my ego in a very kinesthetic way, and I'm all, oh, there's my ego. Wow, this could not be good. My ego could get really inflated right here. And I had to use every ounce of my yogic practice to bring my focus back in, to kind of ground me in. So I've used all of my religious and spiritual practices, you know, that I've learned, I would say spiritual practices that I've learned, to really assist me in processing and integrating this experience. But I have no use for dogmatic constructs whatsoever, because they just don't serve me.
So what do you say to people who want to follow you around and make you their guru?
Don't. Don't do that. Be your own guru. You're your own guru. If you're going to do anything with a guru, eat him for breakfast. You know, the problem is we have too many people trying to tell other people what the right thing to do is, you know, and the right thing to do is for you to find your way and to connect with that source of the divine that is in you. If someone can provide you with a useful practice for doing so, that's great, but it's already in you. You just have to find a way of unveiling it or awakening it. And that's why I call it the Temple of Awakening Divinity, because the fact of the matter is, divinity is waking up in us, whether we want it to or not. It's coming. And, you know, and so it's probably a good thing for us to assist divinity in its becoming conscious in physical form. So in ancient times, not too many people were waking up. You basically had, you know, a few magi or avatars, whatever you'd like to call them. You know, you had your Krishnas and your Lao Tzus and your Gautamas and your Christos and your Moshes, you know, who woke up and told a lot of people. And then their priestcraft needed to kind of help control the people. So then they, you know, came up with all of these rules and regulations for people to, you know, adhere to their particular laws, what you were saying before. But the initial impetus, very likely, well, not very likely, you know, in all of these traditions, is that some guy who usually was either, you know, nobody or somebody, went away and had an experience that transformed them, and then they came back and started talking about it. Well, this is what it's about, you know, having that experience. But the deal is, we can all have that experience. We are all deeply connected to God. We don't need to copy somebody else's experience. You know, now there may be things that help us to get there, and that's great. And you know, then you get into the nice meditation versus medication argument. I don't even know if I want to.
Been there, done that, hundreds and hundreds of times.
Well, good. And there's a great article that was just out last month in Spirituality and Health magazine by a really great author by the name of Steve Kiesling, called Survival Consciousness. That's all about the 5-MeO-DMT experience and kind of comparing it and getting opinions from other kind of spiritual teachers on what they think of that. And of course, they're not too into that because that could just like put them completely out of business.
Yeah, you know, and Council on Spiritual Practices, I think that's whose book that was, the book Psychoactive Sacramentals goes into the whole debate on entheogen versus meditation. And basically, by the end of the book, you had all of the many of the scientists arguing for the more spiritual view and many of the theologians arguing for the more scientific view. So there's an interesting sort of flip-flop in there.
Well, see, and that's the important thing to realize. The deal is that this experience can be created either exogenously or endogenously. So it's easier to create it exogenously from what I've found. I mean, I've practiced yoga for, you know, Raja Yoga for 15 years, very rigorously, and it did not provide what the samadhi provided. It didn't, you know, it didn't get me there even after rigorous work. So I think what's important is finding the safest, sanest, and demonstrable way to get there. And because I believe that there are so many applications of what this really, you know, what this really means that could come out of this, you know, creating genius at will. There's just so much that is untapped and unknown out there. I mean, just in the neurosciences alone, 5-MeO-DMT represents a tremendous leap forward that is not even being explored yet. And the big question is, Why is that?
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. I really, except for a few, your work, Martin Ball and Auroch.
Yeah, you don't really see it out there. You don't really see it out there at all. And there's a lot of, you know, I just want to say to your listenership, there's a lot of misinformation about 5-MeO-DMT out there on the internet. And the other piece that I need to say about that, because I just wouldn't be honest if I didn't, you know, there are definitely some challenges with this medicine. I think it's important to another book that's actually out there on less so on 5-MeO-DMT and more about an experience that it created that I think it's important for people to know about is Robert Augustus Master's book, Darkness Shining Wild, which really talks about having a session not in a ritual context. I don't know if that would have mattered with 5-MeO-DMT and basically going into essentially a psychotic break for 18 months that, if you read that book, was really terrifying. Had some discussions with Martin and Auroch about why that might be, and I don't want to go into any speculations here, but it's important for people to know that this is a profoundly potent entheogenic medicine. And
well,
I think it,
let me interject there that it's possible that listeners might find their answer to that point in Stanislav Grof's work, and I think we discussed that point probably specifically. But you know, it seems to me that the rule is if you're having a bad trip, you probably shouldn't leave it off there because you need to go back through and take care of whatever it was. Okay.
I profoundly agree with that. In fact, I've had, you know, that's a really, really key point because, you know, it's something I said earlier, the variable, especially when I do this in a ceremonial context is the mindset of the individual coming in. And really, you know, I always say that there are two rules at the Temple of Awakening Divinity, only two rules, and they are surrender completely and remember to breathe. And then I always say that nobody's ever forgotten to do number two. So, but this idea of surrender is key because essentially what's happening is, and one thing that I say is that when you ingest 5-MeO-DMT, your ego dissolves completely. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, our ego is a psychic structure that's been developed over, I don't know how long, hundreds of thousands of years, certainly tens of thousands of years. And, you know, I describe it as a capacitor for consciousness. It allows a particular amount of consciousness to come in to our being and, you know, in through our senses. It allows a particular amount of consciousness to flow out of our being. When you ingest 5-MeO-DMT, you remove that capacitor. So therefore, all consciousness floods in, all consciousness flows out, and merges into a non-dualistic consciousness, or what I like to refer to as the singularity of all things. And so that's what you know, so you asked me to describe it. There's your description. You experience the singularity and totality of all things and all consciousness. And it's not as an object. You experience it as you. It's your consciousness. It is the consciousness of the divine, and thou art that. And it can be incredibly frightening to allow everything that you've always known yourself to be to dissolve. It can feel like a death. People who have had difficulty with the medicine have described it as saying, I thought I died. Because they did. And even though they were in the room, breathing, you know, their bodies were just fine, that was their experience. Now, in terms of that, when people hit what I call the fear wall, what Martin describes in the entheogenic evolution as the cage of fear, I have developed some just basic techniques voice dialogue, touch, very simple to, you know, aspects of kind of ontological suggestion that can be dropped into somebody's consciousness. And you have to be very, very careful about that because their psyches are wide open. So it really requires, you know, a great deal of ethical considerations in working in that. To give them some basic coaching, if you will, that helps them ease through that. And sometimes somebody may have to come back another time. I've had several people who have experienced difficulty in releasing fully into the medicine, who have, you know, been very heroic and courageous and have come back, and they've been able to effectively process through and have the full release experience. And it's been very beneficial for them. And I want to talk to this idea of ethics, if I can, because I think it's
sure
very important and it means a lot to me. In fact, I'm kind of working on this now. You know, the sacred communion that we practice in the temples is one of just incredible intimacy and great depth and beauty, and it can be really powerful and challenging, as we mentioned. And so, personally, and with any officiants of the temple, we work really diligently to create this environment of absolute safety and well-being, where communicants can feel that they're held and they're supported within a place of great sensitivity and great vulnerability. And as the nature of the divine gnosis that we receive at the temple is really one of deep love and just abiding love of God, that creating a safe container for that and a conducive environment for that, free, unrestricted expression of that love is absolutely the highest priority and majorly important for us. So in what we found is that the Eucharistic experience produces what, for all intents and purposes, could be considered a full kundalini release within many, if not all, of the communicants that partake, and deeply, deeply opens up the psyche in a really profound way. And now that can manifest in a very sensual manner, and it often does. And it can create actually a really highly charged sensual atmosphere within the temple precincts. And so it's really important that appropriate conduct and decorum in such an environment, it just demands a really high level of emotional and social maturity on not only on behalf of the officiants, but on behalf of everybody participating. And we really have to respect personal boundaries of people and really guard those because their psyches are really wide open. So, and that plays back to this idea of ritual as well. One of the things at the temple is that we utilize ritual and ceremony to create the context. But when people are traveling or experiencing the Eucharist, we don't do anything that would influence that experience at all. You know, it's not about, because it's really about their personal experience with the divine. So, for example, at rituals of the Santo Daime, and the Santo Daime is a beautiful ayahuasca church that is very syncretic in that it combines Roman Catholicism with traditional South American shamanic practices. But, you know, in their ritual, which is pretty amazing, I mean, they are under the influence of ayahuasca and they are singing hymns to God and holding this energy. And it's a very rigorous construct, meaning that, you know, you have men divided from women and everybody's wearing very specific outfits. And there's a lot of Catholic liturgy. There's a lot of Hail Marys and Our Fathers utilized in setting this energy up. So at the Temple of Awakening Divinity, you know, to create a distinction, even though I am using some aspects of Thelemic liturgy, I'm doing it in a context that isn't forcing that ideology onto anybody. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does.
You know, it utilizes it, but it's not saying, well, you know, you need to believe this. Because if you don't believe this, then there's no possible way you can have this experience.
Right.
You know, and much to speak to the Santo Daime, they don't do that either. They, you know, invite people in, they do a nice intake, and then they say, you know, come in and experience our ritual, and they don't, you know, they don't proselytize. And that's something that's really important, is that we're not trying, you know, and I have a lot of respect for the Santo Daime, in that they, and at the Temple of Awakening Divinity, we're not trying to foist our religious belief onto anybody else. In fact, what we're encouraging to do people to do is to bring their religious context, their spiritual context to the temple and experience it in its fullest expression.
Let me ask you, if someone wanted to go to Toad, how would they go about that?
Well, that's an excellent question. So let me just get to that.
Is it like the Freemasons? You have to know somebody who knows somebody to get in?
Yeah, I mean, ask one to be one. The deal is that each, you know, we hold people's participation unless they speak about it. I mean, confidentiality in terms of participation at the Temple of Awakened Divinity is really sacrosanct. So in a certain sense, while a lot of information about the temple is out there, I really consider it initiatory. So in initiatory, especially in magical initiatory orders, you do not out an initiate to a non-initiate, meaning that you would never tell anyone who has not been initiated into your organization that someone else is a member without their express permission, or unless they're completely out about it. So we're really, you know, part of what we're doing, and part of me coming on to a podcast like what you're, like this, is I always have to weigh that and whether I want to do that or not, because what I am doing is a very, very personal experience. So we don't advertise, we don't proselytize. The temple, in a certain sense, is hidden. And so if people are interested in attending, they would really need to find someone who has attended, or somehow or another get in touch with me. And I have no website. I have no email. You essentially have to come into the field of somebody who has been to the Temple of Awakening Divinity and essentially be invited by either myself, another officiant, or an initiate. And then they will then put you in touch with an officiant, and then there'll be an intake, essentially, and a process that you go through to make sure that you are ready to come in. And that includes, I would say, a fairly involved uptake in terms of your physical health, mental health, etc. And then
I was just going to bring that up actually. That's a mm-hmm. very good point. I think that we should take a moment to talk about what are the risks and who shouldn't take 5-MeO-DMT. First off, I think, you know, as with ayahuasca and many of the psychedelic drugs, anybody who has a history of epilepsy, first off, should not mm-hmm. be a part of it. But who else would you add to that group?
Well, let me just say that, you know, safety is really kind of the first consideration, and we make every effort to ensure the safety, you know, physical, psychological, emotional, of everyone participating in the Eucharist. And that really means conferring with each proposed communicant in essentially an interview process before participation to really ensure their preparedness and suitability for attendance.
And what would you screen out on if you would give me the few primary things?
Well, as you know, what we, you know, again, this idea of confidentiality is we let people know about, you know, this idea of confidentiality before coming.
What would you screen out for as far as health issues specifically?
Well, what I'm addressing is that it's not only health. I mean, the first thing that we're really looking at is maturity. So we will generally only have people who are 21 years of age and older participating in the temple, and that's really important to say. There's also a particular level of social, psychological, spiritual maturity that we take into consideration. As far as health concerns, I look for no pre-existing heart conditions, no indications of high blood pressure, diabetes, stroke, or psychological conditions, including schizophrenia, psychosis, manic depressive disorder, and especially in any event, nobody taking any form of antidepressant medications, including SSRIs or MAOIs, will be allowed to take the communion because they essentially can interact negatively with the Eucharist.
And not only that, somebody who's taken an MAOI would probably have a far higher, far stronger experience.
And or at least far, far longer experience.
Yes, yes, exactly. Not only that, but they would be able to ingest it orally as well.
Right. So those are some. There's a couple more. You know, generally, if people are taking antidepressants and they want to come, we will generally say, well, you know, talk to your doctor, and once you've been off that medication for at least 6 months, come back and talk to us. We also say women who are pregnant or nursing should not participate in the communion. And really, I mean, we even break it down to, look, you know, if you come down with a cold or a flu, please excuse yourselves because we don't want to we don't want to make anybody sick. So, you know, that's essentially kind of the screening criteria that we're looking for as far as health considerations are concerned. Now, another one that's interesting is that, for example, when you're doing ayahuasca, there's usually a very rigorous preparation as far as diet and is concerned. And we don't have a lot of those taboos at the Temple of Awakening Divinity. We generally have people come having finished their last meal at least 3 hours before, so that there's nothing on their stomach. There's really no purging involved with 5-MeO-DMT ingested via vapor, via inhalation. Sometimes that can occur. So if you've got something on your stomach, that can come up. It's extremely rare. Sometimes there's some energetic purging, which I've actually experienced myself. That's just because there's energy that's either stuck or blocked that needs to move. And sometimes that's a good way for it to move. But we ask that people not have alcohol the day of. We ask smokers to refrain from smoking a few hours before, just so they're not bringing the essence of tobacco into the temple. But there's no real restrictions otherwise on diet or anything else. If people want to meditate or do purifications before coming in, they're welcome to do so, but it's certainly not required.
So very briefly, if you could tell me a little bit about what you're doing to help legalize entheogens and what you've studied recently on this topic.
Well, I'm hoping I won't have to do anything. And what I am doing is talking to people quite a bit about the importance of direct spiritual experience. I am a strong proponent of Martin's writings on this topic. I am absolutely ecstatic to hear about the Santo Daime's recent win in court in regards to their use of...
They're in Ashland, no less.
Yes, they... in fact, I would probably say that the region of the world we're in here in Southern Oregon probably has some of the most highest concentrations of entheogenic practitioners anywhere in the world, except perhaps the Amazon basin. and you have quite a few different organizations from... the Santo Daime, to there are quite a few other practitioners that work with ayahuasca in the area using different forms. You have a number of roadmen carriers in the Native American church. Temple of Awakening Divinity is very active, and there's quite a bit of entheogenic usage in our little area here.
Yeah. All right. Well, what do you hope to see in the future of your work?
Ooh, wow. Great question. What I would love to see is really a global awakening. And that isn't necessarily from the use of entheogens. It's a shift in global consciousness, really a movement from egoic consciousness into essential consciousness. It's really moving ourselves as a species from Homo sapiens into what some have termed Homo noeticus or Homo universalis, the universal human, or the noetic human. Is a species really on a global level recognizing its direct connection to source, because in recognizing that, we come to see exactly how interconnected we are, exactly how human we are, and exactly how divine we are. So that's what I see, and I continue to work towards that. And I think the thing that's most meaningful to me in bringing this work forward is seeing the openings that people have within the temple and seeing their hearts and minds expanded and seeing the love and joy and ecstasy that pours forth through them, and seeing them leave sessions of the temple absolutely transformed and taking that transformation into their lives and creating lives of great beauty and harmony in the world around them, in however they express that. And so for me, I see continuing to bring this work forward, and in small ways. I really don't believe that everybody is ready for this yet. That's going to take some time. I don't believe in Leary's philosophy of turn on, tune in, and drop out. I don't believe that was effective. And in fact, I think it hurt the psychedelic movement to a certain degree, and that's just opening up now again with people like Rick Strassman being able to do his work with DMT, and Roland Griffiths doing his work, and what maps are doing.
Right, and there's a number of them that are actually, the DEA and FDA have really allowed a flood of new research, thankfully, but if MAPS can get that marijuana to do their vaporizer test that they've been fighting for years, that would be a miracle. If you know, they can get it off the street in 20 minutes, but it's taken them 5 years to get 7 grams of weed to do this vaporizer test.
So this is all incredibly important, and it's all going towards this global shift in consciousness that is happening, and it's unfolding. And I look forward to, you know, this continual awakening, this continual unfoldment of the divine becoming conscious in us.
All right. Let me ask you what you think is the most important aspect of your work that you would like people to take away from this interview.
I'm just going to say this, and whoever hears it, take it in whatever way you can receive it. And that is that divine consciousness manifesting it through ourselves as human in the purest expression of love is what I would like people to take away from this. Now, intellectually, you can hear my words and you can understand that, or you can get it gnostically, noetically, at the core of your being and understand that that is what we are, that we are the fullest expressions of love and consciousness of the divine into physical form, perfect expressions of it into the world. And that when we can move beyond the thin veneer of our egoic consciousness and come into communion with our essential nature, that's what we can truly realize about ourselves. And once we can come to that full realization and drop everything else, everything that divides us, everything that is creating strife and contention in our world, we will create a garden planet of infinite beauty that is so far beyond our wildest imaginations in this moment that the gratitude that will be felt can't even be expressed in words. So that was like waxing all weirdly philosophical. But the fact of the matter is, whether you want to believe it or not, it's absolutely true. And that each individual, through whatever means that they can get there, I can guarantee you, is capable of experiencing direct communion with the divine on the deepest possible level of their being. And so that is what I would like people to take away. I would like people to take away the knowledge, or at least the understanding, that this is possible, that you can have a direct and powerful experience of the divine.
And we've been listening to and speaking with Halucius Nation. This is Gnostic Media's podcast number 35. And Hal, thanks so much for being on the program today. I appreciate your time.
And thanks for making a stretch yawn and bringing someone who's not an academic onto the show.
Well, you know, I think it has some important key elements in what you're doing, and I may or may not agree with every single aspect. And like I said, I may or may not. So
I would hope not. I would hope you would not agree with me on everything.
But I like what you're doing, and you know, I had the willpower to go through and try what you're doing myself, and I've got to say it was impressive. So, anyway, thanks.
No, you were absolutely heroic.
So, anyway, thank you for coming on, and much appreciated. In fact, let me turn off the recording, and I'll talk to you here for a second.